The Katra Podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're jumping into something that affects absolutely everyone. Health, specifically the economics of health and healthcare systems. It's notoriously complex, isn't it?
It really is. It's this fascinating and often frustrating intersection of, well, basic human need and hard economic realities. Huge budgets,
yeah.
Ethical tightropes, systems that sometimes just don't seem to make sense.
Right. And you ask yourself, why is healthcare so much harder to get right compared to, say, making cars or selling coffee?
That's the million-dollar question, maybe even trillion-dollar question.
Exactly. So our goal today is to cut through some of that complexity. We're going to use the work of Jeremiah Hurley, a prominent health economist, to give you a framework. Basically a shortcut to understanding the unique challenges and, importantly, the unavoidable trade-offs in healthcare.
Yeah, Hurley's work is foundational here. He lays out why healthcare just doesn't play by the normal market rules. He's a distinguished professor emeritus at McMaster University, so he really knows his stuff.
And what's interesting about Hurley, I think, is that he's not just locked away in an ivory tower. He's got the academic chops, sure, PhD in economics.
Right.
But he's also deeply involved in applying that theory to actual policy, especially in publicly funded systems like in Canada. He bridges that gap between pure theory and messy reality.
That's a great way to put it. He sees health policy for what it is, this constant negotiation with scarce resources. You know, the theory might look neat on paper, but putting it into practice involves politics, people, and really deep ethical questions.
So he's not offering a magic fix.
No, definitely not. His work is more like providing a map. It shows you the economic terrain, the constraints, the places where you have to make difficult choices. It helps you understand the landscape.
And the core message, the really central idea from his book, is that trying to treat healthcare like any other product, like buying a TV, just doesn't work. The market fundamentally fails.
Right. And it fails because of specific factors. There's massive uncertainty involved. There are effects on others, mm-hmm. what economists call externalities.
Mm-hmm.
There are huge gaps in information. And of course, society cares deeply about fairness, about equity in health.
Mm.
It's just different.
So the big takeaway then is, because the usual rules of supply and demand break down, you can't just let the market run wild. You need deliberate, thoughtful policy.
Exactly. And Hurley's framework helps us analyze that constant tension. You're always juggling efficiency, getting the most bang for your buck with quality of care, and with access for everyone.
And you can rarely max out all three at once, right?
That's the tough truth. You're always trading something off.
Yeah.
Improve access. Costs might go up.
Yeah.
Clamp down on costs.
Yep.
Quality or access might suffer. It's about finding the right balance or maybe the least bad compromise.
Okay, let's dig into why the market fails. Hurley points to four key areas. And interestingly, it starts with how economists even think about health itself. It's not just about being sick or well, is it?
No, it's more sophisticated.
Yeah.
They often use something called the Grossman model. It's a way of thinking about health demand.
Grossman model.
And the core idea is that health isn't just something you have. It's treated as a kind of capital good.
Health as capital? That sounds a bit clinical. What does that mean practically?
Think of it like this. You're born with a certain amount of health, your initial stock. But like any capital asset, it depreciates over time. Aging, lifestyle, illness, they wear it down.
Okay.
So things like going to the doctor, eating well, exercising, mm-hmm. those aren't just expenses. In this model, they're investments you make to slow down that depreciation.
I see. So you're investing to maintain the value of your health stock.
Exactly. And the return on that investment is more healthy days, more productive time, better quality of life. It directly connects health choices to things like income potential and overall well-being over your lifetime.
That's actually a really powerful way to frame it. But, okay, if health is capital, what about the actual delivery of healthcare? The doctor-patient relationship? That seems very human, very based on trust.
And that's where we hit the second major market failure, information asymmetry. This is huge in healthcare.
Meaning the doctor knows way more than the patient.
Precisely. You, as the patient, usually lack the medical knowledge to truly judge if a test is needed, if a diagnosis is right, if a treatment is the best option, or even if the quality of care is good. You have to rely heavily on the provider's expertise and, well, their ethics.
And if the provider is also the one who gets paid for recommending and performing those services, that sounds like a potential conflict of interest.
It absolutely is.
Yeah.
That leads directly to the risk of supplier-induced demand, or SID. Yeah. especially under payment systems like fee-for-service, where the doctor or hospital gets paid more for doing more things, well, there's an incentive, conscious or not, to recommend more services than might be strictly necessary from a purely health perspective.
So the supplier can essentially create their own demand because the consumer, the patient, can't easily second-guess them.
That's the core problem. It's not necessarily about bad actors. It's about how the incentives are structured. It can drive up costs significantly.
Okay, so we have health as capital, information asymmetry. Now let's bring in insurance. You mentioned the two great devils of health insurance. What happens there?
Yes, insurance. It solves some problems, but boy, does it create others. The first devil is adverse selection.
Adverse selection.
Think about it. If buying comprehensive health insurance is voluntary, who's most likely to sign up?
Probably people who know they're likely to need a lot of health care, the sickest people.
Exactly. Healthy people might think, I'll risk it. The premium's too high. So the insurance pool ends up skewed towards high-cost individuals. This forces insurers to raise premiums to cover those expected costs.
Which then makes it even less attractive for healthy people to join.
Precisely. It could become a death spiral, where the market for comprehensive private insurance unravels, leaving only the very sick or the very wealthy able to afford good coverage.
Wow. Okay, so that's why you often need things like mandates or subsidies to make insurance markets work.
That's often the policy response, yes.
Yeah.
To counteract that spiral.
Okay, devil number one, adverse selection. What's the second devil?
The second devil kicks in after you have insurance. It's called moral hazard.
Moral hazard sounds ominous.
It just means that because you're insulated from the true cost of care, you only pay a small copay, or maybe nothing at the point of service, your behavioral changes. You might consume more health care than you would if you were paying the full price out of pocket.
So you might go to the doctor for minor things or agree to more tests because, hey, insurance covers it.
That's the idea. And we have really strong evidence for this. The landmark RAND health insurance experiment back in the 70s and 80s basically proved it.
What did they find?
They randomly assigned families to different insurance plans with varying levels of cost sharing, from free care to higher deductibles. And the results were clear. People with lower out-of-pocket costs used significantly more healthcare services. Doctor visits, hospital stays, prescriptions, you name it.
Okay, that makes intuitive sense. But did that extra healthcare lead to significantly better health outcomes?
That's the kicker. For the average person in the study, all that extra spending and utilization didn't really translate into measurably better health. There were some benefits for the very poor and chronically ill with specific conditions, but overall.
So a lot of that extra care might have been unnecessary or low value.
That's the implication. Moral hazard doesn't just drive up costs. It seems to encourage consumption of care that doesn't necessarily improve health much. It contributes to inefficiency and waste in the system.
Okay, so if the market fails because of these fundamental issues, information gaps, selection problems, moral hazard, we can't just rely on market forces. We need policy interventions.
Absolutely. Intentional design is required. And Hurley emphasizes that one of the most powerful policy levers is how we pay providers. Payment systems are policy instruments.
Right. We talked about fee-for-service potentially encouraging too much volume because of supplier-induced demand.
Correct. It incentivizes activity, quantity over quality, or efficiency sometimes.
So what's the alternative? How do policymakers try to steer things towards better value, maybe more prevention?
One common alternative is capitation.
Capitation, yeah.
Instead of paying per service, the providers say a doctor's practice gets a fixed payment per patient per period of time, maybe per month or per year.
Yeah.
Let's say $6 per patient per year.
Regardless of how many times that patient comes in.
Exactly. The provider gets that fixed amount whether the patient visits once or 20 times. Suddenly, the incentive flips completely. Well, now the provider makes more profit or avoids losses if they can keep the patient healthy and manage their care efficiently within that budget. There's a financial incentive for prevention, for avoiding unnecessary tests and procedures, for coordinating care effectively.
So it shifts the focus from volume to value and cost control. That's clever. It's like behavioral engineering through payment design.
It really is. Different payment systems create fundamentally different incentives, driving different behaviors throughout the system. It's a key tool.
But even with smarter payment systems, healthcare resources are still limited. There's always more we could do than we can afford. How do systems decide what expensive new drugs or technologies to actually fund?
That's where economic evaluation comes in, which Hurley covers in detail. These are the tools policymakers use to make tough choices about resource allocation when facing scarcity.
Like comparing different treatments or programs.
Precisely. One of the main tools is cost-utility analysis, or CUA. It tries to measure both the costs and the health benefits of an intervention in a standardized way.
And that often involves the QAY, right? The quality-adjusted life year.
Yes, the QAY is the common metric used in CUA. It tries to combine both the extra length of life gained from a treatment with the quality of that life. One QAY is equivalent to 1 year in perfect health.
Okay, I get the concept, but reducing life and its quality to a single number, it does feel a bit cold, doesn't it?
It can feel that way, absolutely,
Yeah.
and it's controversial, but the purpose is deliberate. It provides a common yardstick to compare vastly different health interventions.
How so? Give me an example.
Okay, imagine a new cancer drug costs, say, $100,000 and is estimated to provide, on average, an extra two QALYs per patient. The cost per QAY is $50,000. Now compare that to a smoking cessation program that costs $1 million but generates 50 QALYs across the population that helps. That's $20,000 per QALY.
Ah, okay. So the QAY allows you to compare the cost effectiveness of completely different things, a drug versus a public health program.
Exactly. It forces policymakers to think about where they can get the biggest health impact for the limited dollars they have. Do you fund the expensive drug for a few, or the cheaper prevention program for many? It's about maximizing population health gain within a budget. It makes the trade-offs explicit.
It really highlights those inescapable trade-offs again. So if we were to boil down the core messages from Hurley's work for you, the listener, what are the absolute key takeaways?
Well, first and foremost, the idea that health is not just another commodity. You have to internalize that. Trying to apply standard market logic just leads to failure because health is fundamentally different.
Right. And related to insurance, that idea that policy has to grapple with those two great devils, adverse selection and moral hazard. Ignoring them means the system either becomes unaffordable or incredibly wasteful.
Definitely. And maybe the most crucial one for understanding the political debates. There is no perfect health system, only different trade-offs. Anyone promising easy fixes without acknowledging the costs, whether financial, quality, or access costs, isn't being straight with you.
It really emphasizes that tension between efficiency, getting value for money, and equity, fairness, and access for all. You're always balancing those.
Always.
So how can you, listening now, actually use this knowledge? Does it change how you interact with the system?
I think it can, in a few ways. First, on a personal health level, take that Grossman model to heart. View your health as capital. Investing in diet, exercise, checkups isn't just about feeling good today. It's building future productivity and well-being. It reframes those choices.
Makes sense. What about as a patient, a healthcare consumer?
Understanding things like information asymmetry and moral hazard makes you a more critical consumer. You're more likely to ask questions. Is this test really necessary? Are there less expensive alternatives that are just as good? Recognizing that your insurance coverage might make you prone to consuming low-value care empowers you to be more thoughtful.
So, less passive acceptance, more active questioning.
Exactly. And finally, as a citizen, when you hear politicians debating healthcare reform, use the concept of trade-offs as your BS detector. If someone promises better access, lower costs, and higher quality all at once, immediately ask, okay, what's the hidden trade-off? Where's the compromise? If we boost access, what happens to wait times or taxes? If we cut costs, who loses out, or what services get trimmed? It helps you analyze proposals more realistically.
That's incredibly useful. Thinking about this deep dive, what surprised you the most, or what really stood out to you?
For me, it was probably seeing how applying these sort of cold economic principles can bring so much clarity to such an emotional and personal topic. It moves beyond just frustration with the system to understanding why it behaves the way it does. It provides a logical framework.
Yeah, I agree. And for me, the final takeaway is really understanding that the problems we see, the costs, the inefficiencies, the access issues, they aren't just random accidents or simple failures of management. They are, in many ways, the predictable outcomes of these powerful, unique economic forces at play in the health sector.
Right. It's the nature of the beast in economic terms.
And realizing that is the first step. Effective policy, effective solutions, they have to start by acknowledging that fundamental reality, those inherent trade-offs. You can't wish them away.
Well said. It's about making informed choices within those constraints.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acotra Foundation.